I think we are seeing now some huge cracks. We could absolutely fall off the cliff.
On January 6th, 2021, the United States Congress gathered to confirm Joe Biden's presidential election victory. When some senators used baseless claims of election fraud to challenge several state electoral college votes, then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell warned that overturning the election would push US democracy into a death spiral. But it quickly became clear that US democracy was already in grave danger as supporters of former President Trump violently stormed the Capitol building to halt the confirmation process. While investigations into the insurrection are ongoing, President Biden has expressed concern that pursuing members of the former administration could stoke further division. But the insurrection was not the beginning nor the end of the threat to US democracy. With state legislatures across the country pursuing restrictive voting laws and questions over the legitimacy of the US Supreme Court leading to calls for its reform, US democracy remains in crisis. Sarah Turberville, director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, discusses these concerns.
What happened on January 6th, but for maybe a handful of fortuitous circumstances, I think it is completely within the realm of possibility that it could have been successful. I completely share the worries about the state of our democracy. As for President Biden, he is an institutionalist, right? I mean, he spent decades in the Senate. From what I understand about him, you know, there's just this core foundational belief that he has that relationships can lead to compromise. And the question is, at what point is he going to see that that doesn't bear out over the term of his presidency? Notwithstanding, you know, a lack of agreement on sort of, are we all operating from the same set of facts? And I just think we are in a very different place than sort of the politics and the institution that he came from. I just do not see how you can watch what is happening in these state legislatures where there's now almost 400 bills that seek to strip access to voting and to actually subvert the democratic process. Right? The counting of the votes that's handing over to partisan actors the ability to overturn an election. And how can you not see that and believe that that has to be priority number one is protecting the fate of the republic. But at present, I do not see this administration prioritizing like protecting democracy over, you know, what the president promised to do with respect to COVID relief and infrastructure and jobs and healthcare.
Sophia Lynn Lakin, Deputy Director of the Voting Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union, discusses the significant number of bills on the legislative agenda that many fear seek to undermine voting rights.
None of this is a surprise. We anticipated that in the aftermath of historic turnout in the United States, that you would almost certainly see an effort to contract that. And that is because that has happened before. I would say that the number of bills and what the bills are attacking are probably a good sign as to what you know why there is concern here. There are always bills, but this is quite a larger number. Some of the things that we are seeing are the types of restrictions are very much a response to what happened last year. So it's hard to not see it as a kind of a direct response to the voting patterns that were occurred in the prior election here, including attacks on absentee voting, mail-in voting more specifically. And what is also interesting is these attacks on trying to restrict local control of elections as well, which is something new that we have not really seen in this kind of widespread way. And that is hard to see as anything other than an effort to punish and restrict certain local officials who really try to make voting more accessible and safe for voters during the pandemic. The other aspect of it is when you look at where the types of things that they are trying to implement, where those are going to hit the hardest. Those are places with you know the most Black and brown voters, the historically disenfranchised, voters with disabilities. These are tools that they use to vote. that are being attacked, places that they live that are being attacked. It can be more subtle. I mean, more subtle at this point. We don't have, you know, the poll taxes in the direct kind of way anymore, but that certainly hasn't stopped creativity, I would say, ingenuity on the side of people who want to be able to attack political participation by certain kinds of voters. And the justifications keep shifting slightly. So back, you know, a couple years ago, we were talking about voter fraud all the time. Mm-hmm. And we would have to actually go in and say, look, based on everything you've given us, there's no fraud, or it wouldn't be impacted by this law. And that has changed over time. And so what we've seen sort of more recently is this voter confidence piece. It doesn't matter if there's actually fraud, because some people think there's fraud. And so we need strong laws to make people think there is, or voter irregularities. And that is very frustrating from my perspective, because who has created the perception that there is any sort of electoral integrity issues. But I also say it's just kind of odd to have, you know, officials say something like we need to have more restrictive laws in place when they say that there was no election fraud or election irregularity issue in defending the elections. The US Supreme Court has, to a certain extent, blessed, you know, making decisions based on partisan considerations. And in fact, it seems as if Republicans have embraced that much more fully in an argument before the US Supreme Court. You know, attorney for the Republicans expressly admitted that was the case. Some of the reason why they were there was because if you make it harder or easier for certain voters to vote, they are harmed or benefited as a party.
The US Supreme Court, which now has a 6-3 conservative majority, is reviewing voting rights laws among other major social cleavage cases at a time when the court's decisions are often split down ideological lines. Ongoing calls for reform of the court have been reignited by concerns that the court poses a threat to fundamental rights, as well as by complaints that Republican senators have manipulated the court through the confirmation process by, for example, rushing to appoint Justice Amy Coney Barrett in the final days of the Trump presidency, despite blocking Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016. Professor Paul Smith, professor from practice at Georgetown Law and vice president for litigation and strategy at the Campaign Legal Center, comments on the debate.
The combination of the way the nominations were handled from Garland to Barrett, plus the happenstance that we now have a court with a large majority of Republican appointees, even though the Democrats have won the popular vote in the presidency 7 out of the last 8 elections, it just seems bizarre. There's an awful lot of feeling that the court is where it is by illegitimate means, and that will be heightened if the court really does start getting very aggressive. If they do proceed down the path of an extreme agenda, which seems not just possible, but perhaps likely, given all of those events, I think that it is a tool that the Constitution does give Congress to change the course of the court. But it, you know, even all that said, it does have the cost of making people just start counting noses on the court and view the court as more like a political institution rather than a legal institution. And, you know, many would say that's what it is, but the maintaining of the public's respect for the court is an enormously important part of what makes the American government function. In the end of the day, I think that even this court, there would be a majority of justices to do something if the next time we have a presidential election, they try to steal it from the legitimate winner. I mean, I don't feel the need as much as others do to rejigger the court in order to have them ready to deal with the next constitutional crisis, which we may very well get to. But changing the number of justices, I would have been for many years against, on the theory that it politicizes the court and makes the court seem less like a legitimate legal institution to the American people, which is a very large cost. But it does make you feel as if the there might be an argument now.
Fred Davis, former co-chair of the IBA Business Crime Committee and a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, discusses arguments for reform of the confirmation process.
I think that the degree to which the Supreme Court has lost legitimacy in people's eyes is not good. In terms of fixing it, I think the core problem that has to be addressed is for this particular court, lifetime tenure just creates problems. Namely, having, if it's a court of nine people who can choose when they retire and whose lifespan is much, much longer than when the Constitution was adopted in 1789, it means that people are there too long. And then you end up with a politicization of their retirement. I mean, Justice Breyer is under a lot of pressure right now to retire. Justice Ginsburg was under pressure during the Obama administration. Basically, if he were to resign now or not, in a sense, that's a political decision. To me, a proposal that makes sense is fairly simple, and that is to have legislation, which I think Congress can do, that basically says that every president in the first year of his or her term can name one justice to the Supreme Court every 2 years, and that the junior most nine judges sit as a college. And what that basically means is, absent death, each judge sits for 18 years. It would mean that there's just an inexorable, neutral process out there where, two choices per term. But I also think it would be viewed as diminishing the grandeur of the Supreme Court, because a lot of people nostalgically look back at some of the great justices who served for 30 years and made such a great impact. And yeah, I can sort of see that. But on the other hand, it's, that's sort of a cult of personality to me. I think that if the court were to turn into something where, nobody comes to stay, you're not going to be there for more than 18 years, every 2 years it would change composition, because every 2 years it'd be one new person. I think that would change its atmosphere, would make it less of sort of a royal, chamber, and more of a, an ongoing part of government, albeit one that I think still would maintain its independence. Let's say hypothetically one of the any one of the judges, either a progressive or one of the non-progressives, were to resign tomorrow, right? Think of the different way the world would look. Today, what this means is the right wing would say, here's Biden, who, 50% of Republicans think wasn't legitimately elected. And he gets to appoint someone who could be, say, 40 years old and is going to serve on the court for 40 years, right? Think how different that would look if it were, here's Biden, who's going to get the first of his two appointments over the next 4 years anyway, and the worst that's going to come out of it is this person will sit for 18 years, right? And if we win the White House, it's not a question of somebody dying or resigning. We know we're going to get two people. It wouldn't help on today's agenda. It takes so long for there really to be a change in the court. I think the notion of a quick fix, namely getting enough judges on the Supreme Court so that Biden can, get his legislation through, I think that's dangerous. I worship the Supreme Court. I worked there for a year. I've worked on a lot of cases there. And I just think that this is, this is bad that we've fallen into this.
Sarah Tuberville expresses her concerns about the state of the Supreme Court.
I wouldn't say we're there yet, but it is, becoming something that looks a lot like partisan politics that we see in the Congress or in the fight for the presidency. And that's a very harmful thing, because that is not what, a Supreme Constitutional Court is meant to be. I don't think that, it was ever intended for the appointment of a Supreme Court justice to be something that could be viewed as a way to entrench power for decades. The appointments have just started to matter way, way too much. And then there's also just a increasing lack of transparency about some of the decisions that the court is issuing. You might have seen some people who have written about what they call the shadow docket. And this is essentially, the court has taken up with more frequency this practice of, issuing an order or a decision that affects the rights of a lot of people but doing so without the benefit of legal briefing or oral argument, sometimes issuing a decision before they've even granted certiorari on the case. The way the court is currently structured, where you've got 9 people who hear every single case and also make decisions on which cases they select out to hear in the first place, does open up the door for more agenda setting by the justices. One of the primary problems here is the concentration of power in sort of single individuals, because it has a very anti-democratic flavor to it, right? Like, you know, no modern democracy has decided to, you know, create a constitutional court where the same 9 people hold the same position, hear every case, decide which cases they're going to hear, and hold that position for decades. And there's a reason for that. It's an unhealthy thing. You need more churn of individuals and perspectives like that. That would be something that I think would be more healthy in a democracy to have in your constitutional court. In a democracy, like, you've got, you know, what once worked doesn't necessarily always work. I think we are seeing now some huge cracks, and if we don't face them and fix them, you know, I completely agree, we're at the precipice and we could absolutely fall off the cliff. If we don't have some, you know, people exhibit some political courage, which often means, you know, sacrificing your political career to make the right vote, I don't see how we come out of this.